The following is a seminar conducted by John Bowker at the 1991 National Radio Club Convention on August 31st, 1991. The seminar is entitled The History of Broadcast Radio.
Well, good afternoon. I thought that it might be a good idea to start with about a 15-minute warm-up while people are coming in. People who get here a few minutes late. And what we have for you this afternoon is posted in the other room. Did everybody get to see that? Okay, great. And what we're going to start with is just a few minutes of broadcast history, because one of the things that keeps coming up in the DX audio service is, you know, what station was first on the air and who did what to whom and with what. And since nobody really knows, I thought at least if we hear it from one person. Oh, and last year we had a speaker from KDKA. And KDKA came on as the first station on the air, and we'll all accept that. We'll accept that. But it isn't a clean-cut sort of story. So I just thought it might be interesting to go back over what facts we know, and then you can draw your own conclusions. You know, it's been said if it wasn't for Thomas Edison, we'd all be watching TV by candlelight. And you could make a parallel sort of statement on Nathan Stubblefield. Nathan Stubblefield. I don't see any sign of recognition at all. You have, good. Have you ever heard of Murray, Kentucky?
No,
Murray, Kentucky is way out in the western part of the state. Turns out that about 1872, a fellow named Stubblefield set up a microphone and a spark gap transmitter and was able to talk throughout a house, not even outside. They didn't even try it outside, talking to a technician associate of his. And he made some words that the other fellow could come back and say, here's what I heard you say. And he said, well, that's very close. So we all say that Nathan Stubblefield really got the whole radio industry started, although they didn't quite have top 40 rock in mind at that particular time. They didn't have a lot of things in mind at that time. But it's interesting to me that while they had transmitters, radio transmitters, for years before that, the first spark gap transmitters were around 1860 or so, the invention of the telephone mouthpiece by Alexander Graham Bell had been 17 years before this. And it took 17 years for the human brain to come up with the idea, hey, maybe that microphone and wireless could be connected together. I thought that's kind of amazing, thinking back on it. On the other hand, 17 years isn't all that long, I suppose. Then we come up, the next name we come to is Marconi. A familiar name to all of us, but his first radio transmissions were across his hometown in Italy. And he broadcast Morse code transmissions across the city in Italy. Back in 1895, that was the first real communications that they can document. And then just at the turn of the century, he broadcast across the English Channel with Morse code. Everything Marconi did up until the teens was in Morse code. And his famous letter S transmission across the Atlantic Ocean was in 1901 from Newfoundland. Actually, it was received in Newfoundland. So now we come up to the turn of the century, and what we have is everything in place. We have the development of microphones. Edison had already invented the phonograph. We have the transmission concepts, antennas, the idea of transmitting great distances. But it wasn't for another 6 years that somebody stopped and thought, hey, you don't suppose that people, just normal people, might like to listen to a radio, you know, using earphones, of course, because that's all God wanted us to use. But a fellow named Reginald Fessenden lived in Brent Rock, Massachusetts. Where's Brent Rock, Ernie?
I never heard of it.
Brent Rock, Massachusetts. It's on the coast. It's near Hingham. Where's Glenn? Yeah, where's Brent Rock? Isn't that near you?
Yeah, I think it's in Marshfield.
Okay, I picture it as between you and Plymouth, like south.
West of Ernie.
Oh, so it's a long ways from Ernie. Okay, well, on Christmas Eve, you have to set the scene, because Christmas Eve 1906, a very funny thing, a strange thing happened. On that night, Reginald Fessenden, an electrical engineer in Brent Rock, Massachusetts, hitched up a record player to a transmitter, spark gap transmitter, and for the first time that we know, broadcast music and introduced the records. That was Christmas Eve, 1906. And you have to put yourself in the position of the people out in the ocean, 150 miles away, out in these ships, the radio operators with their earphones copying WCC and Chatham or whatever and all that, getting ship-to-shore messages and transmitting back messages back and forth, and they're tuning around, and all of a sudden, they hear music. My God! The concept had just not occurred to people. And indeed, the papers the next day and for a week or two later, as ships would come into shore, were full of anecdotes about what radio operators did, running up to the captain saying, "Captain, put on the earphones." And the captain hearing nothing because the record was over. Yeah. And he played one record. In fact, he repeated it the next night, and Christmas night, Reginald Fessenden. That was 1906, Christmas. And there's little to doubt that that was perhaps even a more solid beginning to broadcasting. I do have some pictures, as I had mentioned earlier. Let me see how these are going to come out. That is a picture of the studio at Brant Rock, Massachusetts on Christmas night. Nobody thought to take a picture Christmas Eve. A year later, actually not a year later, the spring, late spring of 1907, that picture was taken. This is Professor Fessenden right here, professor of University of Wisconsin. That's Fessenden. And the caption under this picture doesn't mention the group. I think it says technicians at Brant Rock, Massachusetts, with their tubular antenna. And that's something Marconi hadn't considered, was a vertical antenna. And that's called a tubular antenna. That was the first vertical antenna that anybody can document used in radio transmission. Well, now, a whole bunch of things happened right after Mr. Fessenden's experiments. 1909 was the development of the Audion tube by Lee DeForest, and that marked the end of the spark gap transmitters. That meant that when you tune to a station after that, the spark gap transmitter hiss disappeared and you had a nice smooth carrier the way we have today. 1912 was the sinking of the Titanic, and that changed everything. Immediately, there were international and domestic radio conferences that set up radio rules, radio acts of 1912. They focused on ship-to-shore and radio equipment on board all the ships and all that, but they also addressed the fact that stations henceforth shall be licensed in this country by the Secretary of Commerce. Unfortunately, about 12 years later, 1924, that was going to fall short when Secretary Hoover was Secretary of Commerce, and all the radio stations were on his back to eliminate the interference problems they were having. And Hoover said, "I only license stations. That's my only job." So they made him president, and he got out of that job real quick. But in 1914, this Professor Fessenden, whom you saw earlier, had by then taken up full-time residency at the University of Wisconsin in Madison and set up a station in Madison, Wisconsin for other than just broadcasts to students in their rooms between classes. Because that had been done starting in 1913 out in Ames, Iowa, by what's now WOI. But the predecessor of WHA in Madison came on the air with entertainment programs, and they were on the air several hours every night for a long period of time. When war was declared in 1917, every radio station in the United States was put off the air except WHA, the predecessor to WHA. They were put on, are allowed to stay on to entertain the troops in the Great Lakes Naval Training Session, I guess the sailors. And so they stayed on the air until the end of the war, and at the end of the war, inexplicably, the University of Wisconsin decided, well, let's put them off because there's no more need to entertain our sailors. The war's over. And that's what really gave rise to the fact that while these various stations had been on the air from time to time, WHA, WOI, WWJ in Detroit had come on the air some time earlier, it still was that a fellow living in that house in East Pittsburgh, here over his garage, had set up a laboratory, and this is a fellow named Frank Conrad. And Frank Conrad set up this equipment in that upstairs room. I'll get the hang of this maybe later on. And went on the air from time to time. The amazing thing was that he actually caught the attention of one of his boss's bosses, a vice president at the Westinghouse Company. And the boss's boss said, you know, we've been selling these amateur radios, that's what they called them in those days, maybe if we announced when we were going to be on the air, we'd sell more of these, and if we could get Conrad to, you know, break away from his work at Westinghouse and go on the air during the day when the department stores are open, maybe we could sell more radios. And so that's why KDKA, which this is, got started. It was started to sell radios and to advertise Westinghouse radios. But in fact, they never did mention the advertising of Westinghouse radios. It turns out the newspaper ads took care of that for them. And they couldn't keep radios in stock well enough. That's a very famous picture. I'm sure you've seen that before. That's a picture of the actual transmission on November 2nd, 1920, which, according to Broadcasting Yearbook, is the official start date of KDKA. Whether we want to call it that or not, Frank Conrad had been on the air for over a year before this. But this was the first one that had actually been announced in the press that everybody says is the beginning of the KDKA equipment. That's another picture of the equipment on the corner of the room, and that's Mr. Conrad. That picture was taken in 1933 to commemorate the anniversary of his working. Might be interesting to know that they moved out of Mr. Conrad's garage and out of the factory building in East Pittsburgh, and this was the original studio of KDKA up on the roof of the building. It was nothing but a tarpaulin thrown over the roof of the building to keep weather away from them. Things moved very quickly. After about 6 months in this, it became winter, and so they moved them downstairs and moved into a studio that looked like that. That is the KDKA downstairs studio. And I show you that only because here is a studio. Do you notice any similarity between these? They look virtually identical. These two studios, the way they're outfitted. This is KDKA in Pittsburgh. This is WDY. DY. Anybody ever heard of WDY? In Newark. Owned by Radio Corporation of America. It was a failure. Roselle Park. I beg your pardon. That was in Roselle Park, my notes show. But the studios of the day were all taking on a very similar slant. Other pictures of the WDY studio, which you can understand I have a few more pictures of than KDKA. They were actually using a telephone transmitter, the kind of telephone that many of you will recall perhaps in your own homes, going back into the late 30s. When they wanted to broadcast music, they took the microphone over and held it in front of the big horn, which was set up for them. The story goes then next quickly to 1926, when this announcement appeared in the leading newspapers of the country. David Sarnoff, who had predicted the rise of broadcasting radio, by then was general manager of RCA, and he talked the General Harbord, who was the chairman of the board, into starting a national broadcasting company. And among other things, that was the announcement that it's going to start on a certain date, or does this say tonight? There were two versions of this. The interesting thing to me is this right here. The WEAF in New York, 5,000 watts at that point, by the way, and blanketing half the radios in Manhattan. Their transmitter was down near Trinity Church. I don't know if in the lower part of Broadway, if any of you know the city of New York at all. RCA agreed to buy that for $1 million from AT&T. And you might say, you know, $1 million back in 1926, that's ridiculous. But there was a little catch to it. And that was an assurance that AT&T would henceforth no longer be involved in broadcasting. And AT&T took the $1 million and ran. And they haven't been in broadcasting since. As licensees, of course. So, that was part of that. I thought it might be interesting for you just to look here. I don't know how many of you can read that, but if you'd like to see this after we're all done. This is a complete list of every broadcasting station in the country on March 1st, 1922. And you can see part of the problem if you look at the next to last column on the right. Those are all the stations, and you see a few of them that are familiar still. WOC, just looking KQW. Guess that one's gone, but KQV is right here. WWJ, WLW. You notice one thing odd? They're all on the same frequency. Every broadcast station in the United States was on the same frequency.
Oh my God.
For about 2 years. Then the FCC said, oh, that's ridiculous. What we'll do is expand that, and so they gave them a second frequency. 360 is approximately 830 kilohertz. 485, this is meters, wavelength meters, is approximately 620. They had those two frequencies. That lasted about 8 months. They went to the Secretary of Commerce and said, Herbert, baby, Herbert Hoover, fix it. And he said, I can't, I only license stations. So they called an emergency radio conference, and in 1925, they expanded the band from 550 to 1500. And that's how that all grew. Just to give you some idea of what that led to, and again, I don't expect you to be able to study this on a chart, but in June of 1926, these were the radio stations in New York City. In April of 27, now what's that, 9 months later, these are the radio stations in New York City. The lines show how some of them move frequency. And less than a month later, here are the stations in New York City, moving, as you can see, helter-skelter. That's what Mr. Hoover helped us create. The last thing I wanted to cover is just to show you about WEAF and what the National Broadcasting Company was able to do with it. WEAF was down the lower part of Broadway. The antenna was on top of the telephone building, which is two blocks up from the Trinity Church, Wall Street, from the stock market. Then, and I see one of the dates on one of my charts is wrong here. That's what was throwing me. They moved WEAF to Belmore, New York, which is out on the island, that red dot. And I don't know how good your geography is, but this is a map. I've cut Provincetown off, you notice, at the top. I think it's got two L's. Yeah. And from here in Belmore, these are convenient listening contours showing where WEAF could be heard. They had to move out of New York City because, as I say, they were blanketing everybody's radio. That's the only station you could get in New York City. But from Belmore, New York, it turned out the newer stations coming on the air, among them was WABC. You know what their call letters are today?
CBS.
WCBS, okay. They were getting better signals than was WEAF out of Belmore. So a number of things had changed, and now the date is correct. In October of 1958, WEAF had changed first to WNBC and then to WRCA, and they had moved to Port Jefferson, which is on the northern part of Long Island, and now they were starting to cover New York a little bit better. They had a little problem with the commuting area in New Jersey. That bugged them, because they hadn't predicted that. And the next thing that happened was the area around that northern part of the island, not too far from LaGuardia Airport, they started building houses there. That's all happened after the war, by the way, as you can see. And so they were starting to blanket everybody's radio again. And so in June of 63, they moved to what is called High Island. High Island in Long Island Sound. It's in Westchester County, actually, part of New York City. And this is the present contours of what was then WNBC. It's now WFAN. I'll close on this with one bit of fun for you. There is a problem that continues, as best I know, to this very day. It consumed a day a month of my time for about 12 years. WNBC, I held the license for that, was at 660 on the dial. WCBS was at 880 on the dial. If you subtract 660 from 880, I'll let you do that, get 220. You multiply that by 3, you get 660 again. If you multiply it by 4, you get 880 again. And if there's any movement of the tower following like a heavy wind with rain, you get a slightly loose rivet. And if any of you have been working around radio frequencies, you know that a loose rivet is called a diode, and that'll give you modulation products. And if you listen very closely on WFAN or WCBS, it's easier to listen to WCBS because they have moments of dead air. FAN rarely does. Listen to WCBS, you'll hear WFAN in the background on 880 on the dial. And it used to be a horrendous problem. But that's one of the things that they had not planned on when they did all their engineering studies to share the two stations on that one tower site. Thank you very much. We're going to carry on now.
How do you want to do this? You want to swing right into...
Why don't we swing right into it? Okay. Your audience is here.
Can I pose a comment or question?
Okay, fine. Sure.
You talked about you started the lecture talking about who was first.
Yes.
But you never really answered the question.
That's true. I didn't, did I?
That, but you neglected to mention several other stations that claimed to be first.
All right. Let me tell you some facts, and then we'll go on from there, okay? KDKA is license number 5. WBZ is license number 1, East Springfield, and unfortunately it's listed as KBZ. That's a purely a typographical error, kind of thing that drives Jerry up a wall. Jerry isn't here. WWJ was in between, I forget, I don't recall. I'll stop. Go ahead.
Okay, what about the station in California?
Well, you know, I have that right here. Let me show you what he's talking about. That has been dismissed by Broadcasting Magazine as not truly part of the logical sequence. Here it is. By the way, if I were going to go on for 30 minutes, I'd give you the story about what killed radio. Unfortunately, every time I tell the story about what killed radio, it also doubled the number of radio receivers in the country. That's the War of the Worlds broadcast, which happened in my hometown, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Yeah. Here is a copy of the listing from Broadcasting Yearbook. And if any of you see that, this particular one is the city of San Francisco, and it has KABL, says C Oakland, KABL-FM, fine. KALWFM, KBRG-FM, C Fremont, KCBS-AM. Well, let's stop here and look at KCBS for a minute. Start date on KABL was July of 58. KCBS is April 1909. Well, turns out it wasn't. It was a different call sign at that point.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. They went off the air for almost a decade, probably over a decade. They certainly weren't on the air during World War I. And so when you talk about the first station, one of the asterisks in parentheses at the bottom is continuous service. But anyway, KQ, look, they conned Broadcasting into calling it 1909. Who am I to argue, right? If you look at the same page for Pittsburgh, you see it says November 2, 1920. And if you look at the same page in Detroit, it says August 20-something, 1920. It's before KDKA.
So for Pittsburgh, who's listed first, KQB or KDKA Broadcasting? Because KQB claims
yeah.
They were before KDKA.
Well, that was the call sign in San Jose. This, by the way, it was San Jose. It wasn't San Francisco. That was the call. KQ.
That's San Francisco.
KQ. CBS. Yes, that's right. But I'm talking back in 1909 was the call sign that they assumed. Wasn't licensed. The K and W call signs didn't come in until WBZ. Unfortunately, KBZ, but that's all right. That's just a glitch. It's one of these things where you look it up in the books and it comes out wrong.
So, John, if it came back on in 1919, then where would that put it? Number two?
piece in this?
Oh, no, they were on the air off and on for 3 or 4 years.
But it came back on permanently.
And it came back on after November of 1920.
Well, it came 11 years then, that's it.
No, I'm saying that they were on the air until about 1910, 12, something like that.
Okay.
I have to admit, that's not my strong suit. But they weren't broadcasting entertainment programs at all with the spark gap transmitter, and that's all they had up until they went off the air. And we're talking about this station,
yeah,
the
I know
predecessor.
It's interesting to me because I hear them brag a lot about it.
Sure. Oh, every time they sign off, I hear them, yeah, sure.
They say it every day.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And so they got an argument. So does WOI, so does WHA, so does WBZ. Yeah, and WWJ that I D's every day with, I think, still, Radio 1. Yeah.
Yeah,
fine.
What about CFCF in Montreal? I understand they played 1919.
Where's Dave?
They have a USL card.
Yeah, I know they do. I have the same card. It goes back in the 40s. They were the first in Canada, they say. CFCF, Dave.
Yes.
What intelligence can you add to this?
Only that they're listed that way in broadcast
year
like this, having come on in 1919.
Yeah.
That, I don't know. Could be the same type of thing. They could have come on for a month and gone off or something.
Possibly so. Possibly so. Yeah.
In the 20s and 30s, there were many stations that were licensed to companies that had nothing really to do with radio. Some of them, many of them had only 5 watts, some even less. And over the years, most of went off the air. One example I know is that's still on is KOIL, which was the Mono Oil Company's. What turned the tide against micro-powered stations like that, and why can't one be licensed now anymore, it seems?
The only answer I can give you is the Radio Act of 1927 divided up the United States, all 48 states, and assigned percentages of total audience to every radio station in the country. And if you're interested in this, I have it out in the motorhome. Little booklet. I don't think I have it here, do I? Beside every station in the listing, beside every station, is its assigned percentage of total population. And you had to have a certain minimum population in order to be on the air. And what that led to in 1933, just before the FCC took over, was the establishment of minimum power. And stations now have, well, up until this crazy post-sunset stuff, all had minimum power. It's been interesting to me over the years to notice that the FCC, if you have 2 competing applicants, almost invariably gives the award to the one with the more power, because they're going to serve more of the public, which is the purpose of broadcasting. Anything else? Great. Thanks. Good discussion. Next thing we wanted to talk about was a follow-on to what we had last year at the Pittsburgh Convention. It has to do with digital audio broadcasting. Thanks, John. And after that talk and after years gone by, I just thought enough questions have come up that it might be good to review what this DAB is all about. It's called DAB, Digital Audio Broadcasting. It's called DRB, Digital Radio Broadcasting. In Europe, it's called BSS Radio, Broadcast Satellite Service Radio, and a whole bunch of other things. We're going to call it DAB just so we don't get too confused. And it occurred to me after explaining this to a group of students at a school in New Jersey, they came up to me and almost to a person when I had been through my 45-minute lecture, which this won't take, they said, "We already have a digital radio," and they meant the digital tuning. And I thought, while this is old hat to many of you, it might just be interesting to a few to recover and recount what a radio station has. Radio station has 6 parts. Sorry, Al, where'd he go? I whacked his loop again for the second time today. Radio station has six parts. First part is the studio equipment. That would be all the microphones and the cart machines and the record players and everything else. Has a transmitter. This is the thing that converts all of the sounds, the audio, so that they're up at a higher frequency and will jump off a wire and go across into space. And the wire that the signals jump off is called the antenna. So far we got three of the six parts of a radio station. Somehow we have to get the sound signals from the studio to the transmitter, and I'm going to abbreviate that and just call it the STL, the Studio Transmitter Link. Just to pause, if you've gone out of sight of the Holiday Inn here and you look, I guess it's in a northerly direction, you see a tower out here with a number 5 on it. That's from the studios of the Channel 5 transmitter right out here, and that is their STL transmitter tower out there. That is not where they broadcast their signals from. That's where their studios are. So that's a tower that looks up, Lord knows where, in that general direction to where their transmitter is actually located that you see on Channel 5. The STL is frequently a microwave system. Not always. Sometimes they just use telephone lines. But it's a microwave system that you don't tune to at all. It's private use. Gets all the stuff from the studio to the transmitter. In here we have another device called a modulator. We're going to focus on this device because nobody knows what it is. And the last thing we have is sort of over here in parenthesis, all the remote equipment. Those are the six parts. Now, this digital audio broadcasting is going to focus on this device right here, primarily. Because if you just stop and look at this list of things, it applies to an AM station, FM station, TV station, shortwave station, doesn't matter. All those stations have the same six basic components. In a TV station, the only thing you add are some cameras. Shortwave stations have to have higher frequencies, of course, than the AM broadcast, but then FM and TV are the same frequencies. The antennas are the same. So things do change, but the modulator can be AM or FM or TV or phase modulator, a whole bunch of things that aren't too popular these days. And the new thing is digital. And what you already know is that if you take a radio and switch it to the AM position, you don't hear FM stations and vice versa, and it's ludicrous to think of picking up TV on a radio. And it's going to be equally ludicrous to try to pick up digital signals on any kind of existing radio. So when this digital audio broadcasting comes along, we're talking about new equipment at the home, at the receiver. All right. Now, the next point is, why would a broadcaster want to go and spend the estimated $200,000 perhaps to get the equipment for digital audio broadcasting? Because if he doesn't do it, then we aren't going to have digital audio broadcasting. Well, if we do have digital audio broadcasting, he's going to be okay, because if not, look at this list. CD records. I don't think there's anybody in the room who would argue, but what CD records has better fidelity than FM broadcasting and AM broadcasting? We now have the DAT tape, if you'll permit the double use of the word, digital audio tape, and we have the new Philips process that isn't quite on the market yet, but maybe by Christmas, which is a competitor of DAT, which sounds very promising, by the way. In fact, using the right Dolby combinations, the cassettes that you have sound better than FM radio. You don't get phase distortion as you drive down a city street. You don't get all kinds of multipath noise and hiss, and it doesn't fade out as you go more than 40 miles out of the city. There are some new things that have come to many of your areas, if not all, and these are beginning to have the word digital in them. the digital cable services. Where we were in New Jersey, for $5 a month, you have a special little device to in your home, and you get what they choose to broadcast, if you'll allow the word broadcast, over their cable, and it's a background music service, and you had five background music services you could select from. Actually, not select from, whatever they programmed into your box, in our case, easy listening. And it sounded just absolutely terrific. Full stereo, of course, no noise whatsoever. And with this list of things, these are all sounding better than FM radio. And so here's FM radio, would be about next. And then there may be some other things. I'll make that an A. Got AM radio. Now, that's going to be the pecking order of quality of sound in your home very shortly, or maybe in some cases even today. And the thought is, yeah, well, okay, but FM sounds good enough. Who needs to go to all, you know, who needs it really any better than FM? And I don't have an answer, but I would exercise this question. And that is, have you tried to buy an LP record lately? Now, again, up until the end of May, I was teaching in a college, and it was a two-year college, and so I have students a year out of high school. These are the people who are going to be going out and having the money here in a few years, if they don't already, and most of them do. And I say, you know, have you bought an LP record lately? And they say, who wants it? I say, what do you mean, who wants it? Oh, they say, you know, how about AM radio? What? They don't know about, you know, the CD or forget it. And these are the people who are going to be making the buying decisions. And they're going to come to a point where FM radio isn't in the market. So, that's an inducement for broadcasters to go into this digital system to get themselves, I'll do this, moved up here somewhere, don't know quite where, in the pecking order, so that they'll be among the best of the systems. Now, if that doesn't convince you, there's one more thing, and that's our Canadian neighbors. Where's what? No, he's gone, huh? Good. No, bless them. You may not understand is that the FCC rules, and of course they're at the crux of all of this stuff, the FCC rules are determined largely by international meetings that occur every 20 years. The United States, by treaty, will make sure that all of its radio rules conform to international law, and every 20 years they have what is called an administrative radio conference, a worldwide administrative radio conference, and there's one coming up next February in Barcelona. It's the 20th anniversary of these meetings. The Canadians have on the agenda a satellite-based digital broadcasting system. They're going to do it by satellites throughout Canada. Now, they're going to use the Anik satellite system, and the Anik satellite system footprint, if you look at it from space, does include most of the United States. Not terribly well, below about here, where we are now. But all through the heavily populated northeast and northwest and central Chicago area, they put down a whopping signal. And you can be sure that that's going to cause some stir as soon as they go with their digital broadcast system. There are a number of things that are not yet determined about that satellite system, but if we do go to a satellite-delivered system, or the Canadians do, the United States simply cannot be far behind, because the Canadians are going to start selling radios like crazy in the United States. No question about it, and we aren't going to be, and Sony is too, of course. So we simply won't be left behind, there's no question.
This would be picked up on a normal radio?
No, that was the point of my first slide. It's going to be totally different, because to the same extent you don't pick up FM on an AM radio or TV on an AM radio, you won't pick up digital on any radio.
Because they already have digital audio satellite out there available in the United States.
Yeah, that's the cable. That's the cable, the encrypted stuff. See, that's not broadcast. As soon as something is encrypted, by definition, it's not broadcast. Broadcast means unencrypted for the use of the people. Okay? All right. But that's the cable service that I mentioned, digital cable. That's where they're getting their signals from. I'm getting too much stuff here on the board. But that you have it where you are, apparently, and we had it.
I have a dish.
Oh, all right. Well, there you go.
And you can't get it unless you pay for it.
There, yes. You've noticed.
Everything else on the dish now.
Fortunately, in the United States, it's not lawful to charge for the reception of broadcast signals. So... Now, there are other reasons why FM owners may want to change. And everything I say about FM goes for AM just in spades. And I made a list of them here. Digital audio broadcasting. First of all, the system that seems to be leading the pack, and there are three or four different DAB systems now being proposed. The system is leading the pack would have a range of about 40 to 50 miles from the transmitter, and 12 stations would share one transmitter. They'd have it on a time basis, where station one would be on for 2/1000th of a second, and then electronically be switched to station two for 2/1000th of a second, station three, four, five, six, seven, up to 12, and then it would come back to station one again. All stations, therefore, would be on a par as far as range and everything else. Therefore, in a given city, there's no interference. You don't have a powerful station and then a weak station. So everybody's on a nice par. So far, that shouldn't be a problem for any broadcast owner. If they share transmitters and eliminate interference, they'll have a better signal-to-noise ratio. They'll have less maintenance. They'll only need one engineer. All these things reduce costs. There'll be no multipath, no fading. Therein lies a problem. They'll have better stereo separation, better dynamic range, and generally better signal-to-noise ratio. The problem with DAB is that indeed there is no fading. In fact, as you drive along in your car straight out, if you're out in the middle of the prairie somewhere, drive straight out from Topeka, Kansas, wrong audience, you know, due west, you've got the signal, it's clean, there's no hiss, there's no noise, there's no multipath, and there's nothing. All of a sudden, I mean right now, bang, and you say, hey, what happened to the radio? Because all 12 stations go off the air simultaneously. So you stop, put on the four-ways, back up, and right here you get it, and right here you and the width of this room, you get it and you don't. It's remarkable. That is what is called a not graceful degradation of signal. And that is the thing about DXing. Don't know. DXing is going to be very interesting. Possibly greatly improved because you get 12 stations all at once. Maybe you won't get any. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. Just so you have the buzzwords, the system of DAB that seems to be mostly ahead right now is called Eureka. It's an English term, and it was their project number 147. So if you read any books, you'll see Eureka 147, and that's the system that the National Association of Broadcasters has said we'll use in this country. Well, there are a lot of people who say that's not fair, it's not right, we can do better than that. And there's a thing called Project ACORN. And this next, what, is this September? No, it isn't September yet. If it were September, later this month in September in San Francisco is the big radio meeting. ACORN and Eureka will both be tested in San Francisco, using KOIT, by the way, as a standard comparison station, the FM KOIT. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. One of these systems, the ACORN system in part, by the way, says that they can do the digital work in the band of frequencies now used by the AM and the FM stations. Eureka would not use those frequencies. It would require a whole new band of frequencies. We'd have the AM band, the FM band, and the DAB band, which would be way up above UHF television. It would be up around 1,500 megahertz, very, very high. The FCC has said that they're going to take the lead and see this thing through. They are not going to do with it what they did with AM stereo, thank you. They have already granted experimental licenses right now for tests on UHF television station channels by radio stations. Just, you know, you go into a town where there's no UHF channel 60, and they say, all right, those frequencies you can use now for DAB tests. And for this new wireless cable stuff, some of you in Philadelphia have wireless cable, where they can't string cables through the streets in Philadelphia, so they have it. All cable in Philadelphia is done by radio. And they're now testing this system on that. And really, the end of what I wanted to tell you about is this. The FCC has said, we are in charge of this, we are on top of it, we are going to push this through the WARC meeting in Barcelona in February. Here are the questions we want answered. You understand, we're in favor of this. All you have to do is tell us this. How much spectrum do you really need? The answer there so far is 32 megahertz. Now, let's compare that with what FM broadcast has, which is 20 megahertz, 88 to 108, and what AM broadcasting have, which is 1 megahertz. They want 32 megahertz for DAB. If we have 32 megahertz, we can accommodate 98% of all the AM and FM broadcast stations now on the air. Because the ultimate plan is that they'll go to DAB and they'll phase out the AM and the FM operations at their own whim. As soon as they decide, well, there aren't any people listening to the AM anymore, they'll just kill the transmitter. When the people say no more FM listening, they'll kill the FM. Wow. And then the game plan is to use those frequencies for mobile operations. But that goes beyond the scope of this. Business mobile, where there's just a terrible shortage of frequencies. They want to look into this problem of degradation of signal at the edge of the range. They want it to be graceful. They don't want it to be, quote, falling off a cliff. That was what Commissioner Coelho called it. He is a broadcast buff, he is. What are the power requirements? And the answer appears to be 20 dB below what is now required for FM broadcast. In fact, the tests in San Francisco on KOIT, any of you going to be in San Francisco the third week in September? Because if so, they are going to be transmitting digital signals 20 dB below KOIT's main program feed. And they claim, they've already done it under an experimental license, they claim that you won't hear a thing. And what that means is if they then turned off all the audio on KOIT, they would still have this 40-mile range of the digital broadcasts for 12 stations that would be free of hiss and good separate the whole... I mean, you got your pie and eat it, too. It's remarkable. So they say, what are the power requirements? And the answer is it would apparently save 20 dB. Fred asked if any of you were familiar with dB. I have an easy way of remembering what 20 dB is. It's roughly the stereo separation between the right and the left channel of a decent... home phonograph. In other words, if you have a tone in the middle on your stereo phonograph and you turn off the right channel, I'm saying this wrong, I beg your pardon. If you record a tone on the left channel, turn off the left channel when you play it back and turn up the right channel, you'll hear a little bit of tone. It's down 20 dB between those two channels. So it's a lot of separation. I mean, it's non-trivial. That's about what 20 dB gives you. The FCC wants to know what the opportunities are for U.S. manufacturing of DAB equipment, both transmitting and receiving. And they're not fooling with that. They may take some serious moves about imported transmitting and receiving equipment. Should there be channels set aside for educational stations in this new system? They did that originally in 34 for AM. They've done it for FM. And it kind of works and it kind of doesn't. So they want to know, is the educational set-aside a good idea for DAB? What will be the real cost to broadcasters to make the switch over? Harris has been asked to comment. Motorola has commented. Two or three other companies have commented. What is the effect on the existing competitive AM-FM balance of stations? That's a question almost anybody could attack and nobody's really going to answer. What is the cost to consumers? And that's pretty simple. It's going to cost you twice as much to buy a radio, and everybody's going to need a new radio. What frequency band should be used? Three bands have been proposed so far. One is the Project Acorn, which is in-band, using FM stations, using FM frequencies. The quality isn't as good. And one of the questions is, should the United States, in a regulatory sense, effect laws that say our system will be second rate? And when you put it that way, the answer is, well, of course not. On the other hand, hey, this in-band system sounds awful good. So who knows? If one transmitter handles a dozen stations, which it would, who is the licensee? Isn't that a beautiful question? How many satellite and terrestrial channels should there be? Because the FCC has already predisposed towards saying that we can't have this all satellite the way the Canadians will. But we're going to have some satellite because the Canadians are. We've got to have some satellite because people are going to have satellite dishes. We might as well grab some of that action, too. But if all of the broadcasting were from satellites, you'd have no local news. You'd have the local politicians wouldn't get any airtime to broadcast at election time, right? So you can be sure that isn't going to happen. So there's going to be a mix between terrestrial and satellite. And the question is, hey, fellas, you can't have all the frequencies. How many do you need, and what should be the mix between them? And by the way, should the educators have a few of those? And then the final question that was raised by the newest commissioner at the FCC was a statement to this effect: I'm not convinced. What happens if we don't participate? And that's the first issue that's being discussed. Meantime, the committee of 11 people, the United States engineers that goes to Barcelona, are in huddles every week in Washington, and they're trying to plan, what is our strategy? What if we bring this up? Now, what if he says that? Well, then we'll get Afghanistan to say this. But now, wait a minute, Afghanistan isn't satellite. Well, we got to get this. And it's a beautiful mix of politics and engineering when you go to the World Administrative Radio Conferences. I went to one. It's just an amazing time to get any agreement on anything. And if you think they come out right every time, they usually do. They usually do, for some reason or other. So that's just the briefing. Nothing's going to happen now until at least February of 92. After that, you're going to start seeing things in the press about the decisions made by the WARC, the WARC, in Barcelona, and how it's going to affect the United States. And then after that, the documents will all be printed. It takes about a year. Then they come to the United States Congress, which ratifies it and recommends to the president. The president signs it, like any treaty. And then that goes to the FCC with the instruction, make it work. And the FCC then usually has about 18 months to make it work. So we're talking about a DAB system that would be really pretty much known by 1992, middle of 92, say, gets sent out for ratification to 164 countries by the middle of 93, comes to this country, gets debated, something will come up, it'll delay it, 95, and the president signs it. And then by 1997, the FCC might have taken action. Probably not before that. Who knows? So that if you squint at all these numbers and say, yeah, well, he skipped a year in there somewhere, by the year 2000, it looks like we'll have a new radio broadcasting system in the country. And I don't know what's going to stop it. I don't see any reason to stop it, because what we've got now is fifth best. We might as well be best best. That's what's going to happen. That's all I had to say. I just thought you'd be interested to get that update.
So we will still meet next year.
Yes, I raised the question about whether this is going to help DX on the AM band. This is going to be great for DXing. You know, when there's only WLW and WBZ left, I mean, that's going to be terrific, right? Oh, and Nelsonville, of course. Yes.
I heard some people talking about this some time ago, and my thinking was that there wouldn't going to be any DXing. You say it goes 40 miles and that's it. Well, then there's going to be any skip or any traffic
enhancement? Okay. Ask a ham radio operator what happens at what is called L band. This would be 12 or 1500 megahertz. And the answer is rarely. It happens, though. Yeah, you get temperature inversions, and they're like the worse than the 10 meter band. In the middle of a sentence, the guy disappears. But, yeah. So I don't know. I don't know. It may be that it's worse than that, because the radio receiver has to be locked into this clock rate of 2 milliseconds. Every 2,000th of a second, the station changes. And its clock is going to be looking for the sync pulse. And if the sync pulse disappears, the radio goes off. That's why it's non-graceful. So the first thing you got to get in is get in with your soldering iron and take off that clock thing, so that maybe what you'll hear is a mishmash of signals, and then you'll have to be able to tune to them. But at least you won't be counting on that incoming clock signal to make your radio mute. You don't want that to happen for DXing. I don't know, it's going to be fun. It'll be a whole new ball of wax. But then they said there would be no FM DXing, too. Whoa, when the band went from the 40s of megahertz up to 100, which it is now, you remember, about 40 years ago, they said, well, that's the end of FM DX. It isn't. Yes, Ernie.
On your top, and then on quality of audio.
Yeah.
My question is, my theory is that people over 40 years old cannot hear a pin drop. Why?
Except on GTE or what? Yeah, right.
Why? How will this help us? How will digital help us? We can't hear it.
That's right. Ernie, I have two answers, both of which are slightly facetious, but not much. Ask yourself how many radio stations cater to an audience over 40. We can all say, well, it isn't zero. There's a bunch. Generally speaking, it is well established that people like you and me and a few others in the room who go nameless have our buying habits so well in hand that there's no way you're going to get me to switch toothpastes or aspirin. I'm not subject to advertising of that kind of a product that's the, you know, or soap. My wife isn't going to change from Dawn, goodness sakes. Therefore, we aren't the target audience, and they, you know, don't care about us. The people with the money are those that are learning how to make decisions right now. And these are the kids that are coming out of high school right now, maybe out of college, and, you know, in their early 20s, they've got the money, they got the buying need, the buying potential, and they are the ones who have grown up with these CD records and things who give me that reaction about LPs, like, who needs them? And the time will come when they listen to FM. And as a matter of fact, you know, already they don't listen to FM that much. I gave them assignments to listen to radio, and they have to, you know, and I say, yeah, I want you to do what we call a clock in broadcasting. I wanted you to do a clock on WMMR in Philadelphia. Tell me why it's the most popular station in this room. We're in Trenton, New Jersey. It's a Philadelphia station. I want you to do a clock. And they, well, all right. A few of them said, sure, that's great. And most of them said, yeah, well, I listen to cassettes in my car. Because they sound better. And they're the ones who are going to be buying the radios. And they're the ones who are the target audience. So, Mike?
Okay. I listen to CDs, and not many people know this. I listen to CDs, and I find that when a lot of CDs are recorded, I find that they do miss out on a few phrases, or they do cut them a little bit shorter. They're not as clear as LPs, but not too many people know about that one. But I don't know about the DAB. My personal feeling is this, that it's really going to be very expensive, and it's going to take away from a lot of local broadcasting in many aspects.
I think everybody may agree with you on that. Do you have a good answer to that?
Well, I was going to say something about the CDs.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm Don Niles. I'm here. I'm considering joining the club. I'm the music director of WOBG here in Clarksburg. And one thing, I'm 41 years old, and I'm working with people 20, 25. I'm the one that can't stand the vinyl. Every time I turn on my radio station, I'm the one that wants to just take the vinyl library and just throw it in the river. And here's somebody 20 years old, disc jockey, you know, I think that sounds great. And I can't stand
interesting.
It. So,
interesting.
So I'm the one that gets in the car.
Must be the West Virginia air.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the one I'm at the point, I'm going to throw vinyl in the river. But a CD, okay, this is, my station is Oldies. Okay. Now, the Oldies started out analog. Now, you digitally remaster this stuff. If it's not done well, it's not so good. Now, today's music starts off digital. It's perfect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But older music, and there's some of it out there in the record store that says, yeah, that if it's not digitally remastered well, then in that case, it's sometimes better on vinyl. So there are certain companies.
I think that's true. I'm a big band buff, and I've heard the same thing on some of the CDs. Hey, I want to thank you all very much for your attention. That's been great, and we'll learn more about DAB every year. It gets closer and closer. Take care.